How true to yourself you always are, my lady, Jane. I would not wish any companion in the world but you.
Her eyes were shining. I love you too.
You do? She smiled.
I do. But I have one question.
What is it, my lady?
Do you see the light through yonder window?
G blinked, confused. What? Jane took his face in her hands.
The sun is up,
she whispered.
See?
It can't be the sun. I'm still a man, G said.
The sun is up, and you are still a man,
Jane confirmed. G closed his eyes, and for the first time in 6 years, 8 months, and 22 days, he felt the sunlight on his skin. He breathed in its rays and absorbed its glow, and there rose a peace in his heart, the kind of calm that comes from the feeling of arriving home after a long journey. His curse was broken. The two lovers embraced, while Edward and your narrators turned their heads to give the lovebirds their moment of blessed union.
Are you quite done?
Edward asked, when lips finally parted long enough for them to take a breath. Not quite. G pressed one last soft kiss to Jane's poetry-inspiring mouth. Now we're ready.
Good,
said Edward,
because there's still something I have to do.
28. Edward. Edward threw open the door and strode into the throne room. He'd done it. He'd gotten into the tower, a nigh-impossible feat. He'd fought bravely and well. He'd dispatched the guards, confronted Dudley, even beaten Bash at swords. And now he was about to reclaim his crown. Everything had gone according to Jane's plan. He was nearly there. He could practically taste his victory. His first surprise was that the throne room was almost empty. He'd supposed it would be bustling with courtiers and members of the Privy Council there to advise Mary and show the Queen their support during the attack on the city wall, but at best there were a dozen people present. Not exactly the boisterous crowd he'd been hoping to witness his glorious return. Still, the room fell silent when he entered, all eyes turning to him, mouths opening in shock. Because even though he was streaked with sweat and stained with blood and not wearing any shoes, he was undoubtedly King Edward, back from the grave. This was going to be good. He turned to the steward stationed next to the door, whom he'd known since he was a young boy. "Announce me, Robert," Edward commanded. The man looked like he was seeing a ghost, which he kind of was, but he obeyed without question.
His Majesty, Edward Tudor!
Edward padded toward the throne to stand before Mary.
You're sitting in his chair,
piped up Jane from behind him.
Mary fidgeted with her handkerchief.
Oh, Edgy, I'm so glad to see you're alive. My heart was simply broken when they told me you were dead.
How dare you?
Edward said to her, his voice so dark with fury that he didn't sound like himself.
How dare you steal what is mine, you poisonous bunchbacked toad?
Ooh, that's a good one. There was a rustle of paper behind him as Gifford wrote the line down. His sister's face paled.
No, brother,
you have the audacity to call me brother after what you've done. I should have you drawn and quartered.
Or would you prefer to be burned at the stake? Purified, isn't that what you called it? Isn't that what you had planned? A great burning of traitors?
It was Dudley's doing,
Mary said softly.
He took your throne because he wanted it for his son. I simply took it back.
Edward laughed, but it was not a merry sound.
"Oh, am I supposed to thank you for keeping my chair warm?" She stared at him mutely. "No more lies, sister," Edward said. "Let us speak plainly now about what's to be done."
This would be the part where she'd beg for her life, he thought, where she'd cry and plead and grovel before him. He wondered if he could ever find it in his heart to forgive her. Probably not.
But in this he was surprised again, because Mary did not beg. She stood up slowly, her back straight and unyielding before him, still wearing his crown.
"You're only a foolish boy," she said at last. "How could you possibly know what to do with this great kingdom?"
"I've been ruling this great kingdom for years," he pointed out. She scoffed. "You call that ruling? You were a puppet of the council, nothing more. And look what we've come to. Ethians running about freely, causing havoc at every turn, savaging the land, defiling our very way of life. You have let this country slide to the edge of ruin. The Ethians are determined to bring us into an age of darkness and perversity, and you are helping them." "I am an Ethian," he said, "like my father before me. I am my father's son."
"And I am my father's daughter," Mary replied hotly. "I am his firstborn child, his only true heir. He may have played at marriage with a bunch of Ethian harlots, but my mother was his only legitimate wife, which makes me, and not you, who are basically a bastard, the rightful ruler of England."
"Huh," thought Edward. He hadn't been expecting her to argue. His mouth opened, then closed again. He wanted to say, "Wait, no, that's not right at all. I'm the rightful ruler. Mary can't be, because she's a woman." But that logic didn't make sense to him any more. He didn't believe it. He couldn't think of what to say. He was quite literally speechless. At his silence, a triumphant gleam appeared in Mary's eyes.
"I am the queen," she said, drawing herself up still further. "All my life I have watched you wrest that title from me. You, a flagrant heretic, a pathetic, trifling boy. You talk of stealing, but it's you who are the thief here. You are the usurper."
"No,"
a voice called out from the back of the room, an authoritative voice. Bess. Edward spun around to watch his other sister come up the aisle. Bessie's grey eyes narrowed as she looked at Mary.
"Edward is the rightful heir to the throne of England because our father named him as his heir. The king can name whoever he wishes to succeed him."
"But father only named him because he was deceived by the foul Ethians into casting aside his good and virtuous wife," Mary pressed, "and only because Edward was a boy."
Bess smiled knowingly. "Wrong, sister. Father left his throne to Edward because he knew, even then, that Edward had the heart of a king. Father knew that Edward would be generous and thoughtful when it came to the welfare of his people, and wise in his decisions. Father knew that Edward would be the best choice for this country."
"Huh," Edward thought again, frowning. He might have been flattered at these words, but deep down he knew that they weren't true. When he'd ruled before, he hadn't given much thought at all to the well-being of his people. In truth, he'd known nothing about his people, and he certainly hadn't been wise. He'd done what he was told, signed what they'd put before him, agreed to the course of action the men around him informed him was the correct one. He had been a puppet, a king in name only. And his father had chosen Edward solely because he'd been born a son and not a daughter. Bess came to stand beside him.
"Edward is the true king," she said. "It's Edward who will lead England to peace and prosperity. He will make England great."
She turned to address Mary. "You would have led us all to ruin.
You who conspired to kill your own brother and pilfer his crown. You who threatened to tear the very fabric of our nation in two. You're a disgrace to the royal blood that runs through your veins. Arrest her! Mary shouted at the guards. Off with her head! The guards didn't move. They looked to Edward. He said nothing. The game is up, Mary. Bess continued smoothly. You've lost. No! The word echoed in the room. Then Mary let out a bellow of rage and barreled toward Bess with outstretched hands as if she would choke the life from her sister. But before she could reach Bess, a light flashed. The onlookers gave a collective gasp. Where Mary had been standing, there was now a chubby grey mule. The first person to laugh was an elderly woman near the front of the room, a stranger to court, people would later remark, but a distinctive figure who gave everyone who played at card games a peculiar sense of déjà vu.
Oh, dear, what an ass, the old lady cackled, and then everybody began to giggle while the old mule brayed and stood there looking generally miserable at the turn of events that had befallen her.
As narrators, we'd like to inform you now that Mary was never seen as a human again. She remained an ass all the rest of her days, as asses typically do.
Edward didn't laugh at her with the others. He turned to the guards. Take her away! A man, it was Peter Bannister, actually, slung a rope around the former queen's neck and led her from the room. Edward approached the throne. It was just a glorified chair, he thought. It wasn't even that comfortable. Nevertheless, he sat down on it carefully and surveyed the room, because that was what was expected of him. The people quieted once more. Then slowly, in a rustle of fabric and a shuffle of shoes, they kneeled before Edward.
Long live King Edward! They said in one voice. Long live the king!
A lump rose in his throat. He didn't feel the way he'd expected to feel in this moment. He didn't feel triumphant or victorious or righteously entitled to the throne. He felt much the way he did the first time he'd been told that he was king, a sinking in his stomach, a dread. Bess bent to pick up the crown from where it had clattered to the floor when Mary had showed the world her true self. She walked slowly and purposefully to stand beside Edward. She smiled. Then she raised the crown above his head, and Edward caught her wrist. Wait! She froze.
Edward, what are you doing? What Mary said is true, he whispered. I'm not the rightful ruler.
Of course you are, she said.
Why? Because I'm a boy. Did you not hear what I said before about why Father chose you?
He looked down at his feet and smiled wistfully. You're the generous one, sister. I never really considered the welfare of my people. I'm not wise. I'm just a boy.
You've never been just a boy, she said.
I don't have the heart of a king. But you do, he said earnestly. She stared at him.
Me?
You're the one who's going to make England great. He took the crown gently from her hands and stood. Jane and Gifford and Gran were all standing near the front, mouths open in shock, even Gran, who he'd always thought unshockable. He wished that Gracie were here. He'd been trying not to dwell too much on Gracie, as she was probably still fighting alongside his soldiers at the city wall, and he couldn't afford to be distracted by the thought of what was happening with her, but he would have liked to have seen her face when he did what he was about to do.
Listen well, he announced to the people assembled. I, King Edward the Sixth, do hereby abdicate my crown to my sister Elizabeth Tudor, who I find, both by her birthright and her immeasurable good qualities, to be the rightful heir to the throne of England.
any rights and privileges I have heretofore enjoyed as monarch of this fine land, I bestow upon her.
Silence. He met Jane's eyes. She closed her mouth and tried to smile. Then she nodded slightly.
"Long live Queen Elizabeth!" she called out, her voice small but strong. She turned to Gifford, who had been clasping her hand all the while, and nudged him.
"Oh, long live Queen Elizabeth!"
he added, and then the other voices began to join in, louder and louder.
"Come, sister," he said to Bess.
He took her hand and led her to the throne.
"Are you sure?" she whispered as she sat carefully in his chair. King or not, it was going to be a while before he stopped thinking of it as his chair.
"Consider what you're giving up."
He knew what he was giving up. Power, prestige, wealth beyond measure, a life of leisure and luxury, a person always standing by to make sure he didn't choke, and, most of all, his future. Edward couldn't honestly imagine who he would turn out to be if he wasn't king. By stepping down, he was relinquishing his very identity. But his country needed a ruler who was worthy and capable. England needed Bess.
"I've never been more certain of anything in my life," he said. "You're going to be a fine queen, Bess. The best. Even better than father. Trust me."
She gave him that subtle, thoughtful smile at his familiar words before she bowed her head for a moment, her eyes closed, her face as pale as chalk. He could see all 22 of her freckles. Then she looked up to address the people.
"Very well. If that's my fate, I will be as good to you as ever a queen was to her people."
"Long live Queen Elizabeth!" they answered unanimously. "Long live the Queen!" Edward placed the crown upon her head.
Let's pause for a moment. We know, we're so close to the end now that you can practically taste the happily ever after. And who would have seen that coming, right? I mean, who could have predicted that Edward would stand up then and right there in front of the Privy Council and all of his adoring fans, he'd say that she, Elizabeth I, should be the Queen of England? Because obviously she was the most qualified for the position. At long last, Edward had arrived at the enlightened state of knowing that a woman could do a job just as well as a man. Yep. That's how it happened. Edward abdicated his throne. Elizabeth would be crowned queen at Westminster Abbey that same week, and we all know she'd be the best ruler of England ever. And now, history can more or less pick up along the same path where we left it. But what happened to Edward, you ask? Well, we still have a little bit of the story left to tell. Edward spent the better part of the next few days thinking about, what else? Gracie McTavish. Because he still wanted to tell her that he'd stepped down from the throne and see that surprised look on her face, and because, let's be honest, he still very much wanted to kiss her. He thought about it embarrassingly often. But the charming Scot was nowhere to be found.
"She'll turn up eventually," Bess said as he anxiously paced the throne room. She picked at a stray thread on the red velvet cushion of the throne.
"You needn't worry, Edward."
Bess was right. Bess was always right, even more so now that she was queen. It was getting annoying. Gracie was alive. There'd been exaggerated tales of a valiant black-haired woman leading the pack during the false attack on the city walls. But then, where had Archer been? And where was Archer now? The entire pack had not yet made an appearance in London. They'd retreated back to the shaggy dog the moment the fighting was done. Gracie, he figured, must be among them. With Archer, probably, Edward thought miserably. Burned bright in his memory was the way Archer had told Gracie that she was looking very fine, and the way that flea-bitten man had ogled her like she was a piece of meat. He couldn't stand the idea of Gracie with Archer, and why wouldn't she have come to see him? Their last moment together in France had ended badly, but so badly that she wouldn't want to see him again?
"Edward, sit down,"
Bess said. "You're making me queasy." He sank into a chair. Pet lumbered up to him, tail wagging. He scratched behind her ear, and she gave a happy dog sigh and collapsed at his feet. Pet had asked to remain a guardian to the Queen, and after all she'd done for their cause, Bess had agreed, even though she wasn't too fond of dogs. Remember? Cat person? It was a little awkward at times, but the least they could do, well, that and give her a scratch and the scraps from the table every now and then.
"Your Majesty,"
came a voice from the doorway, a frightened voice.
"About your crown?"
"What about my crown?"
Bess asked the trembling servant who came to cower before her. Hobbs, Edward remembered the man's name was.
"Have you moved it?"
asked Hobbs.
"Moved my crown?"
Bess frowned.
"Where would I move it?"
"Normally it's kept on a velvet cushion in the king's, I mean, the queen's chamber."
"Right."
Edward and Bess exchanged worried glances. The citizens of England seemed to unilaterally accept Bess as the official ruler of the country now, but if someone had literally stolen her crown, it could mean trouble, not to mention that the crown was virtually priceless.
"Speak, Hobbs," Bess commanded. "Tell us what's happened."
Hobbs shifted from one foot to the other nervously.
"It's gone, Your Majesty."
"Gone?"
"Yes, Your Majesty."
"Gone where?"
Bessie's voice rose, and the servant flinched.
"Gone missing," Hobbs cried. "My job is to polish it. That's what I do every Thursday. I polish the crown. Only today, when I went to retrieve it, I found..."
He started to cry.
"I found..."
He hiccuped.
"I found..."
Hobbs held out his fist, which was clasped around something very small. Much too small to be a crown, maybe a crown jewel, but it meant bad news all the same.
"What is it?" Edward and Bess both leaned forward to look. "Show us,"
Bess said. Hobbs opened his hand. He was sure he was going to lose his head for this, so he was shocked when both the former king and the current queen broke into broad smiles.
"Your Majesty?"
"It's all right, Hobbs,"
Bess said. Edward started taking off his clothes.
"Your Majesty?"
Hobbs was very confused now.
"You don't still need me here, do you?"
Edward asked Bess as he pulled his shirt over his head.
"I can manage," Bess said. "Go."
"Thanks."
He gave her a grateful smile and turned toward the window, shuffling off his pants. Then there was a flash of blinding light, and when Hobbs could see again, the boy who had been king had simply vanished. Hobbs stared down at his hand, at the item he'd found resting in place of Bessie's crown, a tiny wooden fox. When Edward came down to rest on the roof of the shaggy dog, he saw, with his magnificent kestrel eyes, that one of the back doors had been left open a crack. This door turned out to be the entrance to a small storeroom, which was currently crammed to the gills with all manner of freshly delivered food and supplies. A gift, compliments of Queen Elizabeth, as a promise that she would honour Edward's agreement with the pack. In the centre of the floor was something Bess hadn't sent, a stack of clean, neatly folded clothes. Nothing fancy, of course, a simple linen shirt, black pants, and a pair of boots in exactly his size.
Edward put this on so fast that he got the shirt backward at first. When he came out of the storeroom, there was a man waiting for him. The man grunted something like, "She's up there!" and pointed to the hill behind the inn. Edward ran. He came upon Gracie standing at the top of the hill under a large, spreading oak. She didn't see him at first. She was staring out at the setting sun. Edward stopped and drank in the sight of her. She was wearing a long grey skirt and a white blouse, her hair loose and spilling all over her shoulders. She had a small satchel slung across her back and the pearl-handled knife strapped to her belt. He cleared his throat, heart hammering. She turned.
"Sire?"
"I'm not the king anymore," he blurted out stupidly. "I'm the leader of the pack," she said at the same time. He wasn't sure he heard her correctly. "Wait, what?"
"Archer's dead,"
she informed him. "He took an arrow to the chest in the first 10 minutes of the siege."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
A minute ago, Edward could have wished a pox on Archer, but now he felt rather bad for him.
"Did you hear the part where I said I'm not the king?"
"It's all anyone can talk about around here. You didn't do that
for me, did you?"
Her green eyes were genuinely worried.
"No, I didn't do it for you,"
he answered quickly.
"Although, if we're being totally honest here, there was a teeny tiny bit of Edward that really had wanted to give up the throne of England so he'd be free to kiss a Scottish pickpocket as often as he liked."
"I wasn't thinking of you at all." She looked down.
"Oh, I see."
What I mean to say is, I don't want to be king," Edward continued in a rush. "All my life the crown's been forced upon my head, but when I had a choice in the matter, I found I didn't want it."
She bit her lip to keep from smiling. Dimples.
And that was all it took. Edward closed the space between them in 2 strides. He didn't really know what he was doing, only that he had to do something right now or he'd explode. Her warm, heart-shaped face was in his hands, his fingers caught in her curls. She opened her mouth to say something, and he kissed her. He kissed her! He knew he must be doing it right, because after a few stampeding heartbeats, her eyes closed and her hands reached up to grasp at his shoulders, and she kissed him back. Edward felt like he was flying, only his feet were firmly on the ground. He kissed her and kissed her. With tongue, it must be noted. She pulled away, green eyes wide.
"Good Lord," she breathed.
He considered that a compliment.
"You have no idea how long I've wanted to do that."
He tucked a glossy black curl behind her ear, then dragged his thumb gently over her chin. She leaned in until her lips were nearly touching his.
"I have some idea."
He kissed her again. Of course, this whole kissing Gracie thing didn't mean that Edward was going to marry her and that they were going to live happily ever after. But if he played his cards right, who knows? The happily ever after of this book belongs to Gifford and Jane, naturally. But for now, Edward just kissed Gracie, more slowly this time, an explorer of new worlds. Sometime later, he said, "Now give me Bessie's crown back, imp." She laughed and pulled the crown out of the satchel.
"Fine, have it. But I thought you said you didn't want it."
"I don't want it. I'm not a gerfalcon, am I? I'm a kestrel," he said against her ear. "Not a king." She turned her head and kissed him, a teasing brush of her lips on his.
"All right, then,"
she said in her charming brogue.
"But
Just so you know, Edward, he kissed her again. You called me Edward.
Yes, Edward.
She grinned up at him.
You'll always be a king to me.
29. Jane. Okay, we're almost to the happily ever after. But before that, we have to talk about the wedding. Oh, we know there was already a wedding. We mean a second wedding. Jane and Gifford's second wedding was very much like their first wedding, except this wedding took place outside, during the day, and the bride and groom actually liked each other, and they were both human at the time of the nuptials, which was indeed the case at their first blessed union, but given the daytime nature of this one, we thought we should make that clear. Jane and Gifford stood below an arch laced with flowers, a field spreading all around them. There were only a handful of chairs for guests, but every one of them was full. Lady Dudley and G's younger sister, Temperance, were seated in the front row. Edward and Gracie, holding hands, of course. Bess and Graham sat on the opposite row. Peter Bannister and Pet had also come, both in their human states, and this was the first time anybody ever saw Pet wearing actual clothes. Notably absent were those who'd conspired to set up the first wedding. Lady Frances had gone into exile when it became clear she wouldn't be able to manipulate, or pinch, or poke Jane any longer. She ran off with the Grey Estate's Master of Horse, which was quite the scandal. The Privy Council was certainly not invited, and Lord Dudley... Well, Lord Dudley was never heard from again. As far as we know, he lived, sentenced to finish out his days near a sulphur mine. It was that or death, and he chose sulphur. Whether or not he was happy with that decision, we may never know. Anyway, back to the wedding. On everyone's lap rested a book. Any book, in case the wedding got boring. As the priest droned on in the same manner as last time, Jane was both pleased and annoyed that no one was taking advantage of her thoughtfulness. "And now," said the priest, "let us declare the miracles of holy matrimony."
First, true love. With her free hand, Jane squeezed Gifford's, smiling up at him. Love they definitely had. It felt true. Her heart pounded as the priest extolled the wonders of love and finding one's perfect match. "I love you," Gifford whispered, and Jane warmed all over. "We're not to the vows yet," the priest muttered out of the side of his mouth. "Sorry." Second, virtue. Gifford's gaze dropped to peer down her bodice. Jane snorted and laughed, drawing looks from everyone, but she didn't care. Not this time. Third, progeny. Well, that was under discussion. Maybe one day. "Now you may give your vows," said the priest.
"I'm going first," Jane said. Gifford had gone first at their previous wedding, and it was only fair that Jane got to lead this time.
"I, Jane Grey Dudley, hereby declare my devotion to you. I swear to love you faithfully and forever, rescue you when you're in mortal peril, and keep a pantry stocked with apples so that you never go hungry. To illustrate the depth of my emotions, I've written a list of things you outrank." Jane took a moment to unfold the paper flowers she'd been carrying. Gifford shifted nervously, trying to get a look at the writing. She flipped the papers toward her so he couldn't see. "Gifford, I love you more than knitting.
though to be honest, I love a lot of things more than I love knitting. I also love you more than being queen, which admittedly I didn't love a lot. I know I'm not inspiring much confidence at this point, but there's something else I thought I'd bring up. She lifted her eyes to him. I love you more than I love books. Gifford laughed and leaned down to kiss her, but the priest cleared his throat. Ring, then more vows. Kissing comes last. Gifford heaved a melodramatic sigh and offered his hand. Very well. Jane pulled a ring from the pocket sewn into her gown, the same ring she'd put on his finger during their first wedding, stashed in a drawer since that night. Now she slipped it onto his finger and held her hand over his.
I give myself to you. I receive you, he whispered,
and then, louder, I know I said this last time, but this time I mean it with my whole heart. I, Gifford Dudley, hereby declare my devotion to you. I swear to love you, protect you, be faithful to you, and make you the happiest woman in the world. My love for you is as deep as the ocean and as bright as the sun. I will protect you from every danger. I am blind to every woman but you. Your happiness is paramount in my heart. He retrieved the matching ring and pushed it onto her finger. I give myself to you, my Lady Jane. I receive you. Jane didn't wait for instructions to kiss. She stood on her toes and wrapped her arms around her husband's shoulders and kissed him as the guests clapped and clapped. 30. Gifford. What's a wedding without the wedding night? Considering that their first wedding night ended up with a heap of horse dung in the corner of their room, it wasn't difficult to hope for something better this time. And better it was, for G loved his lady, and his lady loved him. And there were no secrets between them anymore, save one. G wanted to confess it to his lady before they commenced with the very special hug. He asked Jane to sit next to him on the bed. There's something I need to tell you.
Go on, Jane said.
G took her hand in his and traced his finger over the delicate skin of her arm. What she didn't realize was that he was scrawling the words of a poem he had recently written. It was inspired by his lady, and he had spent many long hours trying to find the words that adequately conveyed the feelings of his heart. There were many false starts, because at first he tried to capture the moment a horse fell in love with a ferret. Shall I compare thee to a barrel of apples? Thou art more hairy, but sweeter inside. Rough winds couldn't keep me from taking you to chapel, where finally a horse would take a bride. And then he tried to wax poetic about the ferret alone. Shall I compare thee to a really large rat? Thou art more longer, with less disease. One would never mistake you for a listless cat, nor a filthy dog, because my dog has fleas. He could never confess his passion for poetry with those paltry examples. And then, at the second wedding, as G basked in the glow of Jane's radiant smile, inspiration finally hit him, and after the feast he put quill to paper and wrote until he had it right.
Tell me, my love.
You remember how I had a reputation with ladies?
Yes,
she said, eyeing him warily. The truth is, there were never any ladies, nor late-night romps at houses of ill repute. His Jane looked confused.
Then
Where did all the stories come from?
There were late nights, but those nights consisted of...
His voice trailed off as his heart raced.
Of what? Jane said, her mind racing to all sorts of unsavory conclusions.
Bah!
He started to say the word, but paused.
Perversion?
Jane said. No.
Peculiar habits?
No. Well, one.
If you don't tell me right away what it is, I will knit all of your clothes from now on, she said, and she fully intended to follow through on her threat.
Poetry, G blurted out.
Pardon me?
Jane said.
G climbed out of bed and stood at the foot. He pulled out the paper and began his recitation.
My Lady Jane, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
With a deep breath, G tore his eyes away from the paper to assess his lady's reaction.
That was lovely,
Jane said.
You really think so?
Yes.
I mean, I'm glad we will not be forced to live by your quill, because I am rather used to having food on the table, but I appreciate the effort behind those words.
Now, some of you might recognize these words as belonging to a certain Mr. Shakespeare, the likes of whom hadn't actually been born yet in the year 1553. But you should also know that there are all kinds of conspiracy theories about who actually wrote Shakespeare's plays and sonnets, and we contend that the real writer was a very old and very happy Gifford Dudley, assisted by Jane and the immeasurable knowledge she drew from books, who went on writing not to make himself famous or rich, but to make a certain lady happy. G smiled and fell back onto the bed.
You have no idea what a relief it is to hear you say that.
Jane lay down next to him on her side, her head propped up by her hand.
Do you have any other confessions, my lord?
G said. You heard the one about how much I love you? Jane put her hand on his chest and slowly pulled on the tie that held his undershirt closed. G's breath caught.
Yes, I remember that one.
The knot fell open. And you know the one where I don't know much about swordsmanship? Gifford's voice was low and soft.
Yes, I remember that one as well.
Jane tugged at the top button of his vest. G clasped her hand in his.
Kiss me, Jane.
Lips met lips, soft and questioning at first, and then quite suddenly desperate and wanting. And where at their first wedding their wedding night chamber seemed full of the echoes of strangers eager to have their say, tonight they were very much alone. G lost himself in Jane's kiss. He pulled back for a moment.
I have to tell you, Jane, the way you kiss is a work of art.
Shut up and kiss me, Jane said. They kissed again, lips exploring and asking and answering, and then eager fingers fumbled at buttons and untied ribbons, and never did their lips part except for a moment here and there to say it again. I love you. I love you. They collapsed into each other, and although it would be indelicate to detail what happened next, these narrators will tell you that a very special hug does not begin to describe it. P.S. They totally consummated. And now, dear reader, there isn't much more to say on the matter except this. Gifford and Jane lived happily ever after, their destinies colliding quite often, which pleaseth them both. The end. This is Catherine Kellgren. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of My Lady Jane by Cynthia Hand, Brodie Ashton, and Jodie Meadows. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2016 by Cynthia Hand, Brodie Ashton, and Jodie Meadows. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.